Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Today's episode of the Psychology Podcast is brought to you by the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the nation, Blue Apron. Later in the show, I'm going to talk a little bit about my home cooking experience with Blue Apron, but you can try it yourself now and receive your first three meals for free, along with free shipping. Just sign up at blueapron.com/TPP. Again, that's three free meals, including free shipping, when you sign up through our exclusive discount website, blueapron.com/TPP. Now, I'm really excited to introduce Sharon Salzberg on the show today. Sharon is a New York Times bestselling author and teacher of Buddhist meditation practices in the West. In 1974, she co-founded the Insight Meditation Society at Barre, Massachusetts, with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein. She's the author of 9 books, including her latest book, Real Love, The Art of Mindful Connection. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Sharon.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
What a real treat to be able to talk to you. And so a little surreal, I have to admit, considering I listen to you when I meditate every day on Insight Timer.
That's funny.
So to actually have like to interact with the whole person behind that voice, it's pretty exciting. I thought we could talk a little bit about why you have been devoting your life to this. And from what I can read and what you've written about this is that you've experienced some considerable turmoil as a child that made you realize early on the power of meditation to overcome personal suffering. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, it wasn't so much that I realized the power of meditation, but I had some kind of blazing intuition that if I could learn how to meditate, I would be happier. And so I went to India when I was a junior in college. It was through a university program, kind of like your junior year abroad. I created an independent study project. I said, I want to go to India and learn how to meditate. Hmm. And they accepted that. So off I went.
That was in 1970?
That was in 1970, yeah.
And I have a quote here, you're driven by an intuition that the methods of meditation would bring some clarity and peace. And so you had a hunch that that would be the case, yeah?
Well, I did. I had no way of, verifying that until I actually did it.
Well, it's a good thing that worked out. It could have not worked out, right?
So that's could have not worked out. And it was a long time ago. I was going to school in Buffalo, New York, State University of New York at Buffalo. And, I first kind of heard about meditation. It was in the air a little bit because of, the Beatles and music and things like that. But I first really heard about it in an Asian philosophy course. And, I looked around Buffalo and I just didn't see where to find it, to actually learn how to do it. And it was a different world then.
It really, I wasn't even existing.
Yeah. So it was really a different world for you.
Oh, yeah. That's funny. I was like, I almost like instinctually wanted to respond, yeah, it was such a different world back then, let me tell you. And then I realized, I don't know what the world was like for me then. So this is interesting. Before you really discovered what meditation could do for the mind and body, and could you describe at all what you sort of felt like what your consciousness was like before?
Yeah. I mean, I was 18 when I was a junior in college. I'd gone to college when I was 16. And I think if I was going to try to do it in one word, it would probably be fragmented.
Yeah.
I was in a lot of turmoil. My life had been chaotic. My mind was chaotic. But I didn't really understand, I didn't understand the layers of the anger and the grief and, everything that I was feeling. And so it was just kind of fragmented. And it was only when I began meditating that I began going through those layers and experiencing all those things directly.
That's so interesting you use that word. I'm a positive psychologist and I do research, and we're actually just creating a scale called the whole person scale. And one of the items is I feel fragmented.
That's very interesting because people don't often use that word.
I know. And I felt like it was like a construct that was worthy of capturing scientifically, different from life satisfaction or positive emotions. It seemed like something different that so far we're finding some really important correlations with the scale.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. I bet you score pretty highly on the scale now.
I hope so.
Yeah, you'd hope so, right?
There'd be 5 years.
You'd hope there'd be some development there. Yeah, no, I'm sure there is. So tell me about this other turning point you had in 1985 at a meditation retreat in Burma.
Mm-hmm. I started practice in January of 1971, and that was really like a mindfulness practice. And I heard about this other kind of parallel practice you could do called loving kindness. And I heard about it at the end of my first intensive 10-day retreat, and it was offered almost as like a ceremonial way to say goodbye, to end the retreat. You know, may I be happy, may you be happy, and just kind of silent recitation and charging your body in that particular school, charging your body with these sensations, you know, of loving kindness. And I got really intrigued by the practice, and I heard that there was a way of doing it intensively in a systematic structure. So it was only in 1985 that I got the chance to do that with the guidance of a teacher. So I went to Burma for a 3-month period of intensive practice and doing loving kindness practice. So it's not like, you know, divorced from mindfulness practice, but it is its own methodology. So somewhere in the course of that 3 months that I was there, I had this turning point. I have a feeling like many turning points. It doesn't sound like much in words, but it was really very significant. And that is, I realized that up until that point, I had somehow considered love almost like a kind of commodity. It was like a package in someone else's hands. And I would get this image almost like the delivery person was standing on my doorstep with the package of love, and they'd glance down at the address and say, "Nah, I'm going somewhere else." And then there would be no love in my life, and I'd be completely bereft. And the turning point was realizing that's not the way it is. Actually, love is a potential within me. It's a capacity and ability within me. And other people or great art or different scenes might enliven it and awaken it and enrich it or threaten it, but it's mine. It's actually within me. And that was a huge life transition. And it was matched some years later when I saw this movie called Dan in Real Life. And there's a line in the movie that my most recent book is probably almost completely based on, which is, love is not a feeling, it's an ability.
Yeah, you know, we probably share a mutual affinity towards the humanistic psychologists, and like Eric Fromm, Art of Loving, yeah, sort of conceptualization of love was very much along those lines as well, right?
Yeah, I keep meeting very young people who say to me, "I just read the most incredible book on love by Eric somebody." You know? It's like, "Oh yeah, I know what you mean."
Eric somebody. Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, your concept of real love really incorporates that idea of love comes from within. You know, and again, tying it back to the humanistics for just a moment, you know, you used a phrase being love in your book, and Abraham Maslow used the phrase be love, you know, being love. He called it unneeding love. And it seems to just be such dovetail so nicely with the ideas you captured in your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I think there's something about the generosity of the spirit that is love.
Yeah.
But it warrants a lot of examination. You know, I tell the story in the book about somebody I know, a man who told me he felt his move toward a more liberated kind of love, a more real kind of love, was in a way moving off the seat of privilege, you know, and not sort of listening to his wife primarily in terms of how his needs might be satisfied, but,
yeah,
you know, sometimes giving up. Things weren't that convenient for him, but it meant a lot to her. And so he would kind of give her the power. And we're friends, and we used to meet all the time, and he used to tell me these stories about his marriage. And I would say to him, you know, there are an awful lot of people in this world, notably women, but not only women, who never get to express their needs. Mm-hmm. You know, for them, a move toward a more liberated or real kind of love is not giving over to the wishes of the other, you know, and ceasing to be attached to one's own. It's giving voice to begin with to what they want. So I also tell the story in the book about a friend of mine named Gina, who literally outlived her cancer prognosis maybe by 40 years or something like that.
Yeah.
And she told me that when she was first diagnosed, and she was looking at absolutely everything in her life, she said, "I realized that I was the kind of person who'd be sitting in the car with my husband and I'd be boiling hot. And the most I could ever bring myself to say was, 'Are you warm, dear?'" And she said, that changed. You know, so that fascinated me, that balance for each of us or each of us at different times might look different. And the core value is authenticity.
Yeah. No, for sure. And, you know, this striking this balance of getting outside yourself while not sacrificing yourself is such a interesting. I'm just very fascinated with that trait, with that. It doesn't have to be a trade-off, right?
Right. Well, it shouldn't be a trade-off, really.
Right, right. Real love, it's not a trade-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So interesting. You know, this idea that a paradox, you discuss multiple paradoxes. You know, one, sort of the more that we can give love and kind of get outside of our needs of it, the more actually we'll be likely to receive love in return, mm-hmm. is one fascinating paradox. Another one I really enjoyed reading about was what you called the attachment paradox. Can you talk a little bit more about what the attachment paradox is and relationships between modern day scientific notions of attachment and Buddhist notions of non-attachment?
Yeah, I mean, that's always very funny because in Buddhist teaching and in Buddhist psychology, the word attachment is really used as the root cause of suffering. And you don't want it. I mean, you're not seeking to amplify it or cultivate it because it's bringing so much suffering. So, but attachment has a very specific meaning, which is more in the sense of control. You know, if you think of the generosity aspect of love, we know that there are lots of different ways of giving a gift. You can give someone a gift and it's really a freely given gift. And you can give someone a gift because you say they have something you want. And you think, oh, maybe if I give you that, you'll give me that. And you can give a gift really with a timetable of how soon you'd like to be thanked and how loudly you'd like to be thanked. And, you know, there's so many ways of giving a gift. And so those extra things, the strings, the expectation, the need for reciprocity, I mean, things like that, they're human and they're understandable, but they cause a lot of suffering. Because those things are not in our control. We're trying to control something we can't control, like someone else's behavior, someone else's reaction to us. And I think it's also a mistake to think of attachment, even within the Buddhist context, as bad or wrong or terrible. It's suffering. It's a state of suffering.
Good. I like that. I really do like that because this, even though it's framed as secure attachment, it's not really attachment in the sense of like a clinging.
Right, that's right.
Very different than that. And so, yeah, so even though there are these semantic differences, I think there's more similarities. Philip Shaver and his colleagues have written about that. There's more similarities than differences between the Buddhist notions and contemporary scientific notions. That's great. I say this because we just had Chris Fraley on the podcast, actually the episode just before yours, and he talked about the latest science of attachment. And so it was so refreshing and cool to read your book and then see it linked to that literature. This seems like a good place to talk about our sponsor for today's episode, Blue Apron. I recently got the opportunity to try Blue Apron's recipe and fresh and green delivery service, and I really enjoyed their selection of foods, from basil pesto chicken with summer vegetable panzanella to sautéed shrimp and green beans with globe tomatoes and spinach. I'm happy I get to offer our listeners a special discount today. You can get your first 3 meals free with free shipping when you sign up through our exclusive web link, blueapron.com/TPP. This is how it works. You choose your food preferences and desired date of delivery, then a Blue Apron package arrives on your front doorstep. The package includes detailed recipe instructions designed by skilled chefs, as well as all the high-quality ingredients you'll need to make some incredible home cooking, and the package is refrigerated to keep everything fresh and delicious. It's been a great way for me to develop my own skills in the kitchen, and it's been a fun opportunity to bond with friends and family over some really delicious meals. The service is easy, affordable, and flexible. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. Get your first 3 meals free with free shipping. Just go sign up through our exclusive discount website, blueapron.com/TPP. That's blueapron.com/TPP. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now back to the show. So let's talk a little bit about the practice of loving kindness. What is loving kindness?
Well, loving kindness is a term. It's a translation of a word. The word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is metta, M-E-T-T-A. Loving kindness is the usual translation. It's something of an awkward term because, I mean, whoever talks about loving kindness in a casual way. And my concern is that it might make the quality itself seem somewhat arcane or separate. I've had translators, scholars say to me, you should just say love. And of course, now I seem to be. The literal translation of the word is friendship, but there too I have some problems because for me, friendship implies going out to dinner together or going to the movies together, yeah. Hanging out together. And the quality of metta does not actually dictate any sort of action. It's an inner state of connection. It's recognizing our lives are connected. So it's like including rather than excluding. It's looking at the sometimes really rigid sense of self and other and us and them that we can carry around and realize that's just a construct. In a more real sense, we live in an interconnected universe and our lives do have something to do with one another. That doesn't mean you like somebody. Doesn't mean you're going to say yes to their entreaty. It doesn't mean you're going to give any money or spend any time with them. But within yourself, there's that sense of connection.
This is such an interesting idea that you can love someone and not even like them.
Yeah. In reality, don't we find that,
Yeah, no, for sure. And when I do your meditations, you say, now let's broaden the circle to someone that maybe you don't like very much. And I'm not directly quoting you, but you say that's the general idea, let's broaden it to someone we don't like. And then you say, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, then show some compassion to yourself because you're not showing, you're actually suffering by not extending love to this person. Yeah. Could you unpack that a little more? Because I find that so fascinating. The first time I heard that in the meditation, it just really got me thinking,
Well, it's funny. When I was writing this last book, Real Love, I spent a lot of time trying to hear people's stories and insights about love. So I was meeting with groups or I was, soliciting that stuff online. And the last group that I did was in Barre, Massachusetts. And this guy said to me, my whole life, I've been taught and I've thought of liking somebody as kind of the ordinary, expected, obvious, way of connecting. And of course you like everybody, but loving somebody that is rare and hard to attain and, kind of the supreme accomplishment. And he looked at me and he said, "You're reversing it. You're saying we can love everybody and hardly like anybody at all, maybe." And I said, "Oh God, you're right." Because he was right. But that doesn't mean love in the sense of adore or like or want to spend time with or approve of. It's this fundamental sense our lives are connected. And it's like moving from self and other more to a sense of we. And it's maybe not be highly emotional at all, but it's like a shift in worldview.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, I like the idea that no matter how sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, how horrible a person seems to be, they're suffering. And that if you reduce their suffering, you're actually making the world a better place as well as themselves.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about this, though. What about there's a concept we study in our research sometimes called grandiose narcissism. Uh-huh. And those who score very high in grandiose narcissism would never say that they're suffering.
Right.
They think, everyone else are suckers for suffering. So what I'm trying to wrap my head around is for certain particular portions of the population, those individuals, if I said to them, I had in my intention last night that I want to reduce your suffering, they'd be like, don't do that. I'm fine. I'm great. I'm the best, What do you do with that kind of logic? It seems
I wouldn't address them, because the point isn't trying to change them, but somebody just brought that up to me the other day, how incredibly frustrating it is, because this person doesn't seem to be suffering. Not only don't they feel that they're suffering, they don't look like they're suffering,
Right.
Which is so frustrating. Come on. All I could do is agree. It's really frustrating, but I think part of that is also a worldview. It's a sense of what a human being is capable of, and which is a lot, it's not just getting by, not just squashing other people and not just living in a dog eat dog world and not just making money, but a human being is really capable of kind of greatness of heart and real presence and real contribution. You don't have to be famous, just an ordinary person, really contributing to the well-being of others. And then you look at the choices some make and for what they think happiness is. And it's also so ironic that in the end we all die, that we have to give up everything. And you think, wow, you spent a whole life being lonely because you were just taking pot shots at everybody and trying to put them down. And it's quite an interesting way to have spent an entire life and die that way. So there are lots of ways of feeling compassion, even when this person seems incredibly self-satisfied.
I agree. I very much agree. But, sometimes I was joking with my research colleague the other day because I was You know, I'm kind of making this argument in this paper that those who score high on dark triad characteristics, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Like, yeah, tell me.
Narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. It's kind of the common variants of all three. It's like really dark triad. That in some ways I was making the argument that they're not fully human. But then I said, wait, I'm dehumanizing the dehumanizers.
That's right. You know, that's right.
Like they treat other people so they're not human. Is that wrong of me to make an argument that what I mean by they're not full human is exactly what you said, is that they're missing out on so many other aspects of humanity that could bring them joy and happiness. Yeah. That's what I mean by that. But
I think there's something very important in what you said, in that if you see people like that causing harm precisely because they objectify others and they don't recognize the humanity of others. And, you know, if you kick a table, you just kick the table. If you kick a human being and think that they're like a table, that's a big problem. Yeah. And that's the state of disconnection we face, you know, sometimes within ourselves or in others. And that is so dangerous. And you sort of don't want to perpetuate that, you know, by doing the same thing to someone else, even the people who are doing the very thing. You know, you don't want to be engaged in that kind of dehumanization or objectification, you know, as though they don't count, as though they're nothing. And so that's another reason to, even though it's very difficult, to offer loving kindness to people like that.
Well, I think it's a paradox when you're a researcher, because even if I don't want to make those arguments, my data is showing that to be the case. So how do I describe it in a way that with loving kindness? Maybe we should take lessons in grad school and how to report our findings with greater loving kindness.
Oh, I like that.
No one's ever like thought of a course on that. And I'm really going to think that through when I write these papers up, because we are showing that, you know, that these characteristics of extreme selfishness are negatively correlated with growth-related measures.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important finding.
That's worthy of compassion, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's very worthy of compassion. No, absolutely. I found a quote that relates to what you're saying, that a quote from you. Do you mind if I quote you for a second?
No, please.
Okay. We're capable of much more than mediocrity, much more than merely getting by in this world. As human beings, we're actually capable of greatness of spirit, an ability to go beyond the circumstances we find ourselves in, to experience a vast sense of connection to all of life, to settle for walling ourselves off through indifference, or the temporary high of getting what we want by whatever means, or the petty excitement of besting someone, however we can, is actually quite sad. So I love that spirit. And then I wonder, could someone who is in that, like in that state of that petty excitement, for instance, could they feel like it's belittling to hear someone say, just so you know, it's almost like someone say, I prayed for your soul. You know what I mean? It's like, just so you know, I meditated about how I want you to have greater compassion. You could see how that person could take that.
Right. Well, I would never say that to them either. You know, you seem to have a very outward expression of your loving kindness. You know, like, you know, I don't ever go up to somebody. I mean, the classic joke is, you were my neutral person. I felt absolutely indifferent to you when I met you. Then I sent you loving kindness. No, I kind of care about you, you know, but of course we don't do that. We don't say it out loud.
You know, I tend to wear my heart on my sleeve. So
I guess you do.
I think I get in trouble sometimes because of that. No, that's hilarious. So that is a common joke in your community. Yeah. I love it. I absolutely love it. Okay. So I love this quote from psychotherapist and meditator Linda Carroll, which you quoted in your book, saying, loving yourself is holding yourself accountable to be the best you can in your life. Narcissistic love has nothing to do with accountability. So tell me a little bit about the important role of responsibility and accountability in cultivating greater love in your life.
Well, some of this is, it all ties to like a very deep question, which is, what do we mean when we say love? You know, loving kindness for ourselves or for someone else? Because for a lot of people, that word, that idea, you know, implies a weakness, a certain sentimentality, being conflict avoidant, overlooking faults, just trying to dwell in what's nice and sweet, you know, and it can mean a lot of different things. And that's a problem, you know, is kind of clarifying that. And so, you know, and people, somebody brought this up to me the other day, when I was doing a talk with a musician and songwriter and teacher of those things. And she described some of her students who, I don't really feel like studying, you know, I'm going to be good to myself. You know, I feel like I don't want to learn the tradition of, and the history of, like, the lineage of this songwriting thing, you know, I want to be spontaneous, you know, and she was very funny. And of course, we can confuse it with that kind of indulgence, and usually it is confused. or being a doormat, not fighting against anyone else, or just being complacent and passive. And, you know, so I think it merits a lot of consideration. Like, what do we mean by love? What do we mean by love for ourselves? And I really like what Linda Carroll said in that sense of responsibility or accountability. It's like, if you really loved yourself, maybe you would, you loved yourself more, you're cultivating that, maybe you would try in whatever domain, you know, you felt was out of your reach, unreasonably so.
Yeah, it is a very good point. You know, we've been trying to measure a loving orientation, you know, on a scale, and we create a new scale to measure a loving orientation. You would love this stuff, you know, like I want to tell you, I'll share papers and stuff with you when they're published. But what's one interesting correlation we found, and I'm basically, this is like not even published yet, so I'm telling you like top secret stuff in front of a large audience that's listening. Yeah. We found an interesting correlation between those, the most loving people show the highest level of what's called survivor guilt. But what that actually means is that you feel guilty if you achieve or success, great success, and others are not achieving your success. You do feel guilty for your successes, as well as a form of guilt called omnipotent responsibility guilt, which is the most loving people feel responsibility for the suffering of anyone that's around them. And it's been argued in the literature these are actually adaptive forms of guilt, but in their extreme manifestations, of course, you don't want to constantly feel guilty for being your full expression of yourself.
Yeah.
So it's a potential, it seems like having a loving orientation can come with great joys and a full existence, but there are some things to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I find really fascinating because right away, of course, my mind went to Buddhist psychology and meditation practice. And the first thing that came to my mind was this quality called equanimity, which is actually usually taught in conjunction with loving kindness. And equanimity is a balance. And in that context, it's the balance born of wisdom. So it's like perspective. Mm. So that means that every action, every moment of loving kindness or compassion, you want supported by wisdom.
Yeah.
Right? You don't want it, you know, you don't want those ever separated. And so that's really how we practice. Otherwise, loving kindness becomes attachment. Like, may you be happy by Tuesday night. You know, I've got a big list of people to make happy. Or it's up to me to ease your suffering, you know?
Yeah.
Which is a kind of funny construct, but very prevalent. Or, I mean, maybe that's part of survivor's guilt. You know, like, if I delight in the, you don't even have to be a loving person to have that. You know, like, you know, people who have a very hard time absorbing pleasure or savoring.
Yeah.
Know the delights that come their way because there's too much suffering in the world. So they're not actually doing anything about the suffering, you know, but
right. It's
just feeling bad. And so what's that about? It's very interesting to look at. You know, so my mind went right away to equanimity and bringing in that kind of balance. Like, I will care for you and I care about your pain and I will do what I can to ease you. And it's not in my hands
in the end.
This is not my universe to control. What about the balance between loving kindness for oneself and for others, you know, so that it's multidimensional. It's not just in one direction. Or what's really interesting, you know, these days is what about having compassion for someone and feeling so completely divergent from their views and their actions that you just resolve, I'm going to fight them, but maybe not with hatred in one's heart, but from a different place.
I like that. But yeah, you do tend to find a correlation between having a loving orientation towards others and having a loving orientation towards yourself. And the flip side, those that have an antagonistic orientation towards others tend to have an antagonistic orientation towards themselves.
Uh-huh.
You know, they turn it inward. We turn inward what we put outward as well. You know,
Yeah.
So there is a correlation there. So it does seem like cultivating real love in any form will have benefits in like a larger system, so to speak.
Right. Well, I think about that a lot, actually. And that's interesting that you say that, because I seem to work a lot with caregivers, people who either in their personal lives or their professional lives are serving the needs of others. And there is such massive burnout.
Yeah, empathy burnout.
What's that about? Yeah. And so, exactly. And so, you know, these are people who have tremendous empathy and they have great love for others often. But what's not happening, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, the research shows that loving kindness, compassion is the antidote to empathy burnout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Mathieu Ricard says he feels when someone's suffering or he sees someone in pain, he doesn't feel pain, he feels a sense of warmth. And I guess that's more motivates you to actually do something, right? To actually approach the person as opposed to hide.
That's right. Stay in bed.
Yeah, because you feel so upset. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
So tell us a little bit about, I really love the part in your book about the stories that we tell ourselves as well as stories others tell about us. What's the role of stories here in connection to love?
Well, I really like that part too. It's at one point I had an editor who, after I'd written stories we tell about ourselves, she said, that's enough. But I was really determined to go on.
You're funny.
And do some stories.
I'm glad you did go on.
Thank you. Well, yeah. It has a lot to do with the role of assumption in our minds. And I also tell the story in the book somewhere about a friend of mine who was a writer and a speaker, and he gave a talk somewhere. And in the course of the talk, he mentioned how when he'd been younger, reading Proust had been very important for him, and reading Remembrances of Things Past. And so after the lecture, he'd gone out to dinner, and he was sitting in this restaurant, and this small group approached him. This woman kind of emerged from the group to talk to him, and he took a look at her and he thought, oh, she looks really kind of uneducated and, you know, maybe not that smart or something like that. And the first thing she said was, I was at your lecture. So his heart sank. You know, what's she going to say? And she said, I really liked your lecture. It's just that I find I get a lot more out of reading Proust in the original French. You know, so that was a moment. I was like, oh, okay, you know. And it's fascinating, those assumptions that come up about the person, about the type of person, about ourselves, you know, gender, race, anything, you know. And so one of the great gifts of mindfulness, of course, is to be able to see these things so they're not unconscious or half conscious. And then we can just look, true or not so true, or based on what, or, you know, maybe I'll just listen for a while and see if it's true, or whatever choice we make. It's actually very empowering. And so one of the biggest feeders, of course, of those assumptions is those stories, you know. And we tell stories about ourselves, you know, we need to be perfect. We need to be better than perfect. You know, that wasn't good enough, or it might have been great, but it wasn't good enough, you know. And so those stories really so deeply affect our every moment. And then the stories others tell about us, even the stories others tell about life, you know, like, I don't know if this is in my book or not, but it's a story I often tell in teaching about going to Washington, D.C., often to teach for a while. And one year, a friend brought me to the area, the basin where there's this big concentration of cherry trees. But we only got there at night because it was so busy. And they all kind of bloom at once. That's cherry blossom season. And a friend of mine, having heard that the previous year I'd only gotten there at night, was determined to get me there during the day. And we did it. We managed to get there during the day. And I just thought, this is so beautiful. So many trees and these delicate pink blossoms, and it's so gorgeous. And then my friend said, oh no, it's past the peak. And I thought, oh no, I'm having a bad experience. This isn't good enough. It's not the peak, right?
As soon as they said that, it changed the whole flavor of things.
Changed the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, so there's so many stories about us, about life, about someone else that we carry, and our goal is, and we're not going to dismantle the narrative making capacity, nor would we want to, but we want to be able to see those stories so they're not these kind of hidden assumptions.
Love that. I love that. Yeah, I tend to be very influenced by the energy of someone I'm with and sort of what I think they think of me.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm not a mind reader, so I don't know exactly what they think of me. So in a lot of ways, I'm trying to guess the story. I'm doing a lot of work, a lot of acrobatics there that is just only going to increase my own suffering, aren't I? I just realized that talking to you, there's like second level, like suffering, intentional suffering. Like not only do I not really know what they're thinking, but because I then think something negative that what they're thinking, it then influences what I think about myself, my own narrative I tell myself.
Right.
And I'm sure I'm not alone and the only one who does that. You know?
Right, of course.
But yeah. Oh, it's so interesting. Yeah. We would reduce a lot of our suffering like right away if we just dropped a lot of this. Great. Okay. So you talk also about welcoming emotions, welcoming our sort of full breath of emotions. Do you think that, and again, in this whole person scale that we're creating, we have this idea of I don't feel real or I feel split off from myself. And you talk about that as an important thing in your book in terms of having real love. So what is the connection there between sort of imposter syndrome and real love?
Well, I mean, I think if you don't think of love as a state, you know, with all its implied, you know, characteristics or qualities, euphoria, delight, rapture, whatever we associate with love as a state, but you think of it more as the way we approach things, you know, so it's more relational, you know, how am I with my toothache? How am I with myself when I, you know, meet a stranger? How am I with a stranger?
Yeah.
And again, if you don't think of love as like gooey, you know, but but as powerfully connected,
yeah,
you know, then you can see that to think of, oh, you know, I have anger, it's bad, I'm wrong, I'm horrible. It's not really like that. You know, the process, the path isn't really like that. You know, but more, how am I with this anger? How am I approaching it? How am I with myself in the face of the anger? And that's really the point. It's the point of mindfulness. It's the point of loving kindness. And so, you know, to sort of feel I shouldn't feel what I'm feeling, it's all wrong, is not that helpful, because we are feeling what we're feeling. You know, that's authentic. And much more empowering is the question, how am I with what I'm feeling?
Right. Am I sort of just being with it, or, yeah, trying to control it? Yeah. And you have this phrase, this is so cool, emo diversity. The whole spectrum of human emotions. I love it. Did you coin that phrase?
I don't think so.
Okay. But,
I don't know where I heard it. I must have heard it somewhere.
Maybe not.
There's another one I used in a previous book, Unitasking. I'm not sure if I made that up either.
That's great. So I think that we'd be remiss if we didn't run through your RAIN model a little bit.
Yeah.
Just quickly, because this RAIN can be applied to a multitude of someone's life. So it's a really valuable tool.
Yeah. I mean, so we say mindfulness, like when something comes up and we're working to be mindful of it, we want to avoid two extremes. One extreme is hating it and fearing it and being ashamed of it. Let's say it's anger. This wave of anger comes up. You know, we don't want to just get lost in being afraid of it and trying to repress it and, you know, make it go away. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is diving into it and letting it take over and being completely defined by it. Like, such an angry person, they always will be, right? So we say mindfulness is the place in the middle where we're neither like getting lost in what's happening, nor are we trying to push it away.
Mm.
And that sweet spot in the middle is sometimes described by this acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N. And different teachers actually have different R's, different words for the R and different words for the N. So it's kind of an evolving model. But what I used in the book was R is recognizing, like, oh, there's anger. The A is acknowledging, and some people would say accepting, you know, so it depends on how you use the word accept, but like, yeah, this is what's happening right now. You know, I don't have to fight it, and I don't have to get lost in it. It's like, this is the truth of the present moment. I is investigating, and in this sense, it would not mean, you know, trying to figure out why in the world I'm still angry after 45 years of meditating or something, but looking into the anger, like first feeling it in your body, what do I feel, and looking in, sort of like looking into the anger movie. And when we see that, when we look without holding on, without pushing away, we see, oh, there's a lot in there. There's sadness in there. There's fear in there. There's a sense of helplessness in there, usually. So we see it's a composite, and it's really a compound. And we see that it's constantly changing. You know, this quality that came up that seemed so impermanent, I mean, so permanent and so impervious to change and so rigid and so solid. Look at that. It's moving. It's changing. It's shifting. And then the N is non-identification. You know, like you don't have to say, oh, I am such an angry person. You see that this was a passing state, right? It came and went due to conditions. And so that's RAIN. I've heard some teachers lately describe the N as nurturing, like nurturing yourself anyway. You know, even though this is not the emotion you would have asked for, anyone gave you a menu. So there are lots of ways of kind of doing it, but I find it's a really kind of good way of sensing what mindfulness is.
Absolutely. And are you familiar with the ACT and commitment therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Some of those ideas are being applied, you know, in therapy for a really good effect and tied to that notion of psychological flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, which of course they drew so much on the Buddhist philosophy. So a lot of this stuff is drawing on Buddhist philosophy and to very good effect.
Mm-hmm.
So I have another quote from you. Yeah. Don't you just love when I quote you?
Sure. It's always a surprise. I said that?
It's so funny. So we cannot will what thoughts and feelings arise in us, but we can recognize them as they are, sometimes recurring, sometimes frustrating, sometimes filled with fantasy, many times painful, always changing. By allowing ourselves this simple recognition, we begin to accept that we will never be able to control our experiences, but that we can transform our relationship to them. This changes everything. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I'm the pull quotes editor here, you know.
Thank you very much.
So I want to be very mindful of your time. And in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to just jump into the domain of romantic relationships. Like what happens when we take love and we actually like the person as well. So we like and love, that comes together. We have great admiration for a single person that we want to have deepen in a romantic, passionate way. Yeah. Let me just bring up another paradox here, because it's talked about a lot, but I kind of personally think it's kind of a false paradox, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on it. You know, like one of my favorite writers, Esther Perel, the psychotherapist, Erotic Intelligence, talks about this fundamental tension between the need for excitement and mystery, and then security and familiarity, and how they're two naturally opposed forces, you know? And so that's why we tend to lose passion in a relationship over the long haul, because we have too much intimacy. That's sort of that model. But can you maybe speak to that a little bit?
Well, that's interesting. And obviously, you know, romantic relationships are extremely complex.
Yeah, there's no one kind of romantic. Obviously. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, from a meditative point of view, it's also interesting just to look at the simple role of attention. Like, how often do we stop paying attention to our partner, you know, or our person or whatever, whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
You know, any amount of boredom or complacency or taking someone for granted or whatever, you know? So I think mystery doesn't necessarily only come from that sense of, you know, excitement. Doesn't necessarily only come from the unknown. It comes from discovery sometimes, and we see discover each other, right?
I just love that.
Okay.
I just love that. Yeah. And that's, yes. And that's so much tied with sort of everyday awe, everyday wonder.
Yeah, that's right.
Curiosity that's right. That is self-sustaining. Oh, that's beautiful. What a great way to reconcile that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you just gave hope to lots of people that want to have like 50-year relationships at least.
Pay attention.
Okay, so let me quote you again here. Time is both the implacable thief who steals away the gifts of life and the sacred messenger who bestows them. Even as we live with the knowledge that each day might be our last, we don't want to believe it. Yet when we're able to open to the truth of even our most shattering losses, we find moments of unimagined grace. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. You did say that, right?
I did. I guess I said that.
It's so poetic. So poetic.
Thank you.
So I kind of wanted to end on that vibe. You know, like I wanted people to leave this episode today kind of feeling a vibe. But did you want to elaborate on that at all in real time or riff on it or improvise?
That was very beautiful. I'm glad I said that. Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, getting older is a trip, you know, and it's the most surprising. It's like shocking, you know, especially since I went to India when I was 18. And so many of my really close friends I met when I was 18 years old. And that was a long time ago, you know, so you feel like it's all just racing by. And yet, you know, when we are present, it's almost like this timeless realm, and it's a whole other way of being. And we have both, you know, both are true for us. Originally, my book ended on the story of a Tibetan teacher of mine who I had gone to see in Taiwan. He was very frail, and we had seen him, and, you know, it was a small group of us struck by how incredibly ill he seemed. And then he told us he was moving from the heart of the city to some suburb or something, and we could come see him in another couple of days. So a couple of days went by, and we were all standing in front of this hotel with flowers and fruit and offerings for him. And I was so, you know, depressed and unhappy, and I kept thinking, I might only see him one more time, and it might just be one more time. And then we all got into these little cabs, and every cab got lost. I was just wandering around the streets. And then all of a sudden, I was thinking, all I want in life is to see him one more time, you know, and the one more time, which had seemed like the worst thing in the world, suddenly seemed like, wow, that would be the biggest blessing. And in fact, you know, we did find him. We saw him many more times, you know, because he lived quite a number of years after that until he died. And But it was so interesting. One more time. Seemed one way, then it seemed another way. Totally different.
I mean, I think it sucks that we can't, you would say, you know, it's just surrender, you know, but that we can't control a moment in the way that we can't capture it forever. Yeah. We can't bottle it.
I agree, it sucks. You know?
It sucks. It kills me sometimes, you know.
On that note.
You know, it's hilarious. Because, you know, I just have these moments where I kind of know in some senses that it'll be the last time I'll see you. Like I had a very dear mentor who's old. And I was right, you know, I was like, what if this glimpse of this person right now, this is it. Like, how can I just freeze frame this? You know? And and it was the last time he died of complications of an operation. So to kind of turn this into something maybe more uplifting, mindfulness may be our only tool to get as close to the freeze frame that I'm yearning for as possible.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you know, that transition to, you know, wow, I would be grateful for one more time was an important transition, you know, not to take things for granted and not to just be complacent. But this life is an incredible gift. And
sure is. Well, it was a gift to chat with you today. Thank you so much, Sharon. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much.
Again, this episode was sponsored by Blue Apron. Sign up and get your first 3 meals free with free shipping. Just go to blueapron.com/TPP. That's blueapron.com/TPP. Thank you so much for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking as I did. If something you heard today stimulated you in some way, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com.